and welcome to Fishy Business, a series dedicated to exploring the lesser-known side of cybersecurity. I'm Alice.
And I'm Brian, and we're colleagues at Mimecast. Every episode, we'll be joined by a special visitor who's definitely not your average guest to share tales of risk, reward, and ridiculousness.
We'll be looking for new ways to think about cybersecurity, to learn how we can all improve in the fight to stay safe.
Alice, have you heard the one about identity theft?
Oh, Brian, have you just attempted a joke because we've got a stand-up comedian on the show today?
I believe I just did. I normally try and do dad jokes, and I'm pretty good at those, but I think I fell flat there. But in fairness, it's also the name of our guest's book on the podcast this week. We're going to be talking to Bennett Aaron, a stand-up comedian, writer, and unfortunately also a victim of identity theft.
We're so happy to have you with us, Bennett, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
My pleasure. Lovely to be here. Thank you.
Now, before we start, we'd love our listeners to be able to get to know you a little bit better. How would you introduce yourself to people at a dinner party, for example? Do you find as a comedian, usually you're asked to tell jokes on demand?
Yeah, I very, very rarely say what I do for a living, because that's the first thing that people will say. If I say I'm a comedian, they'll say, "Ooh, tell us a joke," which is bizarre. I mean, that doesn't happen with other professions. If somebody says, I'm an accountant, then, you know, people don't go, "Ooh, can you add up these numbers?" Or, you know, if they say, "I'm a gynecologist," well, it doesn't matter. But it doesn't happen with other professions, but with comedians. So I normally lie, to tell you the truth.
Normally what happens when I tell people what I do, they roll their eyes and start shuffling in their seat and try and find somebody else to go and talk to. So at least you get asked to do something interesting.
I get asked to do something, yeah.
But for any aspiring comedians and writers, you know, how did you get the start in your career?
Well, I started off writing for TV. I started writing sketches at a time when you can just send them in as an unknown writer. And the producers came back and said, "Oh, we really like these." And they commissioned me to do like 5 minutes of original material, which was great. So I sent that in. And then there was one particular sketch that I sent in, which is one of my favorites. And the producer came back and said, "This isn't funny." And I said, "Oh, no, it is." And he said, "Well, it's not." And I thought, well, he's paying, so I better agree with him. But it really bothered me, because I thought it was funny. I thought the only way I could ever find out how funny it was to try it out myself. So I wrote this as a bit of stand-up. I never really wanted to do stand-up. I'm naturally very, very shy. But I thought that's a way of finding out. So I did that, wrote myself 5 minutes of material, went on stage, did it, and it went down very well, and that was it. And it sort of got me hooked. So my career, I guess, took off from proving a producer wrong.
Well, that's amazing. And I know we wanted to talk a lot about your book today. I found it fascinating reading it through. It actually scared me a little bit, thinking, oh God, I need to check all of my bank details and those kinds of things to make sure that I haven't been a victim of identity fraud. But I know that your book, Heard the One About Identity Theft, is your personal story around your experience of that type of fraud. Can you tell us a little bit more around why you decided to write it?
The reason I wrote the book, it was twofold, really. I wanted to share my experience with people because I wanted them to learn about the subject so they didn't become victims as I had. And also, I wanted people to know what happened because, as we'll no doubt talk about, I made a documentary on the subject, and I wanted people to know what that experience was like as well. So it was for people to know about the potential consequences of fraud and identity theft, and to know sort of what can go on behind the scenes with television documentaries. It's not always what you see on screen. And I'd been writing a diary for years and years, and when I started making the documentary, I carried on writing the diary. So a lot of what's in the book is taken almost verbatim from the excerpts from the diary. Also, I was arrested for making the documentary. And when I was in a cell for a few hours, I was given a pad and pen, something I asked for. It took them actually an hour to decide whether or not they were going to allow me to. I don't know what they thought I was going to do with this, you know, pad and pen. I mean, paper cuts can be dangerous, but I'm not going to cut myself out of it. Anyway, so and I wrote some stuff in there as well, and all that is in the book. So it's all, a lot of it is actually genuine stuff that was written at the time. And the feedback has been really incredible from the book. So I'm pleased I did it.
And that's quite interesting because, I mean, not many victims of certain types of crime and especially cybercrime actually report it, and even less talk about it publicly and do all of the things that you've done. Why did you feel the need to go into that kind of level? And possibly one of my famous compound questions here, but is why do you think many victims do stay silent?
What happened to me was actually pre-cybercrime. It happened to be pre-internet. And my case was one of the first major cases of ID theft in the UK. And people didn't know about it. And I spent most of my time trying to convince the police, trying to convince companies that I was me and not the person pretending to be me. And I wanted to share that. I wanted people to know the difficulty of the obstacles you come up against when you're dealing with fraud, when you've got to report it. And I think a lot of the time people don't report it now because they know that, A, it's not going to be taken seriously enough. It's going to be looked upon as a victimless crime. And I think people just don't bother doing it because they know that it's so far down on the list of emergency and important crimes that they just don't bother with it.
And that seems really unusual, though, because it actually has some serious consequences. You know, what do you think we can actually do about changing people's attitudes to reporting particularly these kinds of cyber crimes?
It has to be looked upon as a serious crime as burglary, as theft, because, you know, if you report your car is stolen, okay, that's something tangible, that's something that's gone, something that can be seen, something that can be looked for. If you say your identity is stolen, from the authorities' point of view, well, what does that mean? You know, what have we lost? That there's nothing gone, and that's why it's not taken as seriously. And what people don't understand is that having your identity stolen is a far worse crime than having your car stolen. Your car can be replaced. Replacing your identity, or rather getting your identity back, getting your status back, is a really, really tough thing to have to go through. And I think that there should be much more awareness of this. I think authorities should know how important it is to deal with these types of crime. Because when you have a zero credit rating, there is very, very little that you can do until your name is cleared.
And I know, Bennett, you initially found out about this, or it was brought to your attention because you were looking to buy a house and you found that you were supposedly in massive debt through it. Can you tell us more about that? I understand that you initially thought that it was potentially a mistake.
Yeah, well, I had a letter. What happened? I was buying a house and everything was going fine. And then suddenly I had a letter from the bank telling me that they had discovered all my outstanding debts, so they were stopping my mortgage, my loan. And I knew this wasn't me. I'd never been in debt, I never owed money to anybody, always paid off my credit card bills in full. Even as a child, I always paid off my monthly contributions to the Olivia Newton-John fan club, even though I never received the promised lock of hair. So I knew this wasn't me. So I spoke to the bank manager and I said, you know, what's going on? And he said he couldn't help me. He said, I know you've got a good reputation with the bank. There's nothing more I could do, but I know that this is being stopped. And that was the first sign that something was seriously wrong. And, you know, I had to get credit reports, and I'd found out later that this person had been doing this for over a year, and I knew nothing about it. And I don't know how long it would have carried on had I not applied for this loan to buy the house. So it was, yes, that was the first point, really.
And how did that feel when you initially found out? What was going through your head at the time?
It was literally unbelievable. It took me a while to come to terms with the fact that somebody was pretending to be me. I mean, why somebody wants to be a short, fat Welsh Jew is beyond me, but somebody had decided to do that. And it was just really, really odd to think that somebody, because as I said, fraud, identity theft was more or less unheard of. Identity theft certainly was unheard of. You know, this is going back 20, 22 years. So, you know, I understand that companies and the police were saying, what are you talking about? It must be you, it's your name. So it came as a huge shock, and therefore it was so, so difficult to sort everything out and having to do it all on my own. There was nobody to help me. There were no companies that would help. There was no infrastructure in place to help people who were victims in this way. So it was really tough, really tough.
And I mean, what interested me was you seem to have to, firstly, as you say, convince the police that there was something wrong. But more importantly is that you weren't fraudulently reporting a fraud. How do you think that police should respond to these types of crimes? You know, what sort of understanding should they have? You mentioned in the book that you say even the top policemen agreed that police have very little regard for ID theft. What do you think needs to be done to help victims from the police perspective?
There has to be an understanding. There's a loss. There is a loss that's part of this. And although it's not a bereavement, a loss of identity does sometimes feel like that because a part of yourself has been taken. And that's a really awful feeling to know that a part of you has gone and that there is someone out there that could be doing anything in your name. I mean, that's all we have. You know, what's unique to us really is what we look like in our name, those two things together. And to think that somebody is taking one of those things is really, really upsetting. And authorities have to understand how devastating this can be for victims.
And I can imagine it must have felt maybe like a violation of your personal space, you know, somebody kind of completely encroaching on all that you know, and as you say, all that kind of defines you. And it sounds like your situation thereafter kind of deteriorated very, very quickly. You moved out of your rented accommodation, but then found that, you know, money ran out quite quickly thereafter because of the series of extremely unfortunate events after discovering the identity theft. That must have been an incredibly stressful time. Were you surprised by how quickly things started to deteriorate thereafter because of this event?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the speed in which these things escalated was quite phenomenal, really. And a lot of it was due to the fact that companies were allowing accounts to be opened in my name without taking the correct procedures. They were too fast to accept that this person pretending to be me was me. I've got copies of the forms that this person filled in my name. My date of birth is wrong in almost every form, and my name is spelt incorrectly. Now, I might not be the brightest person in the world. I'm going to get my name right. You know, so checks were just not done, and that's what caused the problems. And this is what annoyed me and angered me the most, the fact that this escalated because they were too fast to take on new clients.
And I know you mentioned that initially this experience happened 22 years ago. Do you find that nowadays those kind of poor practices are still taking place, or do you find that things have improved somewhat?
Things improved a bit, but I know companies have a fine line between how many hoops do we want potential customers to jump through to the fact that we don't want to lose their business. So I understand that. I understand that. But I still get credit card applications sent to me through the post with my details filled in. I mean, if I can't fill in my own details on application, I probably shouldn't have a credit card. So, you know, there's stuff that they still need to do, really.
And I think that's actually something that's super challenging is it seems a little bit unfair that the onus was on you to fix the problem. You know, all the companies were doing was just trying to close as much business as they could. But I was quite impressed with some of the detective work that you actually managed to do. And it seemed to involve mainly contacting companies who, you know, had been part of this whole chain. And you've ultimately found the criminal and found out how they'd actually impersonated you. Could you maybe share some of the worst data sharing practices that you encountered during your investigations?
Well, yes, I did manage to track the guy down. I think one of my favorite things was that I rang a company when I found out that an account was open in my name. I rang a company and said, you know, is there an account? I explained the whole situation. I said, is there an account in my name? They said, yes, there is. I said, is this an active account? They said, yes, it is. I said, do you have an address for the person with this account? They said, yes, we do. And I said, brilliant. Can you give me that address? And they said, no, we can't. And I said, why? They said, you just explained it's not you, so we can't give you someone else's personal information. And I said, but they're fraudulently pretending to be me. And they said, and therefore, not you. And under the Data Protection Act, we can't get that information out. I mean, it was just bizarre, these things that I was coming up against constantly. But I did eventually, as I managed to track the guy down and gave his name and his address to the police. So, yeah.
And I think something that really struck me through reading your book was, you know, you were hit by event after event after event. And I remember actually saying to my partner, you know, I can't believe this all actually happened to one person. But to see you pick yourself back up every single time and show that real resilience, you know, not only with yourself, but your wife and your family as well. Resilience is a key topic that we like to talk about a lot at Mimecast. And how do you think that kind of impacted you, and what was your strategy in kind of coping with these recurring events that happened to you and finding that resiliency within?
I think my mentality was, look, things can always be worse. I think that's the only thing that kept me going. You know, they were bad. I mean, there were times when, you know, we had to move in with my parents. My wife was pregnant at the time. It was awful, awful. But I kept thinking, look, it could be worse. It could be worse. We could literally be on the street. At least I've got somewhere to live. So that's what I had to do. Every time things were, as far as I was concerned, at their lowest ebb, and there were times when it was so, so completely devastating, where I'd look at my bank account and I had, you know, nothing. My car was stolen at one point. And it was just like everything. But I kept thinking to myself, look, things are bad, but they could be worse. And we will, you know, we will eventually come out of this, which, you know, eventually we did, although it took a lot longer than I anticipated.
And it's definitely inspiring, as you say, kind of seeing yourself, picking yourself back up, dusting yourself off and going, right, okay, you know, let's look to resolve this. How can we make, you know, the best out of a bad situation? And I know that you managed to find kind of the funny side, if we can call it that, in terms of turning your experiences into a very successful one-man show. How did that feel in terms of, you know, maybe getting revenge or a little bit of triumph? Was reliving the experiences you had to go through quite difficult from a retrospect?
You know, it's funny. I did it for two reasons. Again, it was to let audiences know about my experience, to stop it from happening to them. And it was for a cathartic reason, just to, you know, get it off my chest. I never expected at the time that I was going through all this that one day I'd be doing, you know, an Edinburgh Festival show about it, or that I'd be asked to be the guest speaker at so many events talking on the subject. But there are moments now, and I've given my talk, you know, over 1,000 times, and there are still moments, even now, where in the talk, the memories come back. There are two or three moments where I feel myself getting really, really emotional. There was a time that my wife was, we went to move to Spain. My wife's family are in Spain. So we went there for a while. We just didn't know what to do. And I realized I couldn't do anything there. So I left my wife and I came back to try and find somewhere in the UK for us to live. And that moment of being alone and sleeping on a friend's floor and in a borrowed car and having no money and looking from one awful apartment to another and just completely breaking down. You know, those moments that I talk about in the talk do come flooding back, and I just have to give myself a second every time before carrying on. But it's nice. I mean, I never expected to have found, you know, humour in the story, but I'm pleased that I have. And the feedback I have from the book and the show is that people are shocked that they are laughing 1 minute and really upset for me the next.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can definitely say those are the feelings that I was going through as well when reading your book. And I know you then managed to turn that really successful one-man show into then a documentary later on around ID fraud and how easy it is to essentially commit ID theft. What are the main things you'd advise us in terms of trying to keep ourselves safe wherever possible?
Well, I always tell people, you know, shredding documents is important, obviously, with ideally a cross shredder, only because a normal straight shredder, bizarrely, the pages can be stuck back together, which I've seen done. So at least for the cross shredder, it makes it almost, not impossible, but almost impossible. So I advise that. And I go around, as well as speaking conferences, I go around companies and I talk to staff in companies about the risks of not 100% checking that phone calls and emails and texts are genuine. You know, we all sort of think we won't fall for it, but so many of these look so clever and they know when to catch people.
And it strikes me that you're kind of doing a sort of cybersecurity awareness training, although it's personal, not aimed at the company side of things because it's identity theft. And something that also strikes me is, and maybe you can comment on this, is how do you feel humor, you know, what role do you think humor plays in getting people to remember things? Because, you know, what you could have done is written a very serious book about identity theft and all of the do's and don'ts, but you chose to make it funny. Was there a reason behind that?
Yeah, I mean, I do a lot of cybersecurity talks, and I do in-house videos for companies talking about cybersecurity, about phishing and vishing. And they're all, the reason I get booked to do them is because I do them comically with a message. So the fact that I can, in theory, make a serious subject funny seems to help. People like to laugh. People remember funny things. And the fact that you can go from one emotion to the other seems to help it for the message to stick in that little bit more. Also, I'd have really big difficulty in doing something that wasn't funny.
And I know as well, after your documentary, and I'd like to ask you later on actually where we can potentially watch it, because I'd love to see it kind of from start to finish. But after you finish your documentary, and I won't reveal too much with regards to the book and some of the inner insights that you provide us there, but we know that you were arrested. And what did that experience feel like? You know, as you say, all of this happened to you out of no fault of your own, completely out of your control. And then, you know, you'll film your documentary to provide insights to people and to warn people about, you know, what could potentially be happening to them without their awareness. And then you find you get arrested. What was that like?
When I was commissioned to do the documentary, one of the things that in the contract, it actually stated, in the unlikely event of arrest, we will not give you legal representation. And I said, sorry, what? And they said, well, no, it's fine. Don't worry. Just sign. And I went, well, that's not going to happen. And I said, why arrest? Why do you think there's a potential for arrest? Oh, no, there's not. There's not. You know, it's in the public interest. It's fine. Can you just sign it? And I said, no. I'm not signing this. If there's nothing worrying, if there's nothing's going to happen, then take that clause out. And I'm pleased that they took it out, because when I was arrested, they had to give me legal representation. Otherwise, I would have had to pay for that myself, which would have been incredibly unjust. So when that happened, because I'd been told that there'd be no repercussions. This was by, you know, a TV company who said, no, it's fine. You're an investigative journalist. It comes under that umbrella, so it'll be fine. So when, at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was arrested, you know, by three members of Scotland Yard, two men and a woman. I don't know why there were three. The woman could have taken me on her own. You know, I was shocked. I've never been so scared in my life. I was taken and put into a cell and kept in there for hours and hours. And it was, I honestly didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if I was going to jail. I didn't know if I was going to, when I'd see my wife and kids next. I remember I was halfway through 24. I hadn't seen that. Didn't know how that was going to finish. So, you know, there was a lot going on. So it was really scary and worrying.
And I know throughout your documentary, there's a huge amount of kind of incredulous experiences where it's like, wow, you know, how does that happen? Did that really happen? We don't want to kind of spoil too much of it for our listeners, but are there kind of one or two key experiences that you had that you found maybe the craziest or the most ridiculous?
Oh, yeah. there were a couple of things. I set up a shopping stall in South Wales. That's South Wales, not New South Wales, Australia, South Wales in Swansea. And I said to people, I can stop you from having your identity stolen if you give me all your personal information. And I didn't think anybody would fall for it. I had a queue of people as I was setting up the store, a queue of people around the block waiting to give me everything, their mother's maiden name, their passwords, their pins, the three numbers of the back of their cards, absolutely everything. So that came as a huge show. I wasn't expecting it. I mean, it was great and surprising. And then the other thing that happens, which I really enjoy, when I give my talks, if I'm speaking to companies or at conferences, I'll usually ask if anybody's been arrested. And I've had some brilliant stories where people have told me about the reasons they were arrested. I remember there was one guy, this was a show I did, and I said, anybody been arrested? And a guy put his hand up and said, I have. And his wife next to him said, no, you haven't. And he said, no, I have. And she said, what are you talking about? What for? And he said, running an illegal gambling ring. And she said, no, I know about that. That's not you, that's your cousin. And he said, well, actually, we did it together. And you know, I told you we went away on a holiday together last year for 2 weeks. We were both inside, right? So she burst into tears, right? She got up and left the room. The guy stood up, pointed at me and went, you shouldn't have asked, which is brilliant. Like, I'm getting blamed for what happened. So, yeah, so that's fun.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. We always like to end our episodes by asking our guests three simple questions.
So, Bennett, looking back at your career, what's the one insight that you wish you'd learnt sooner, or maybe that you could go back and tell your younger self?
There are a couple of little things like don't eat too much. And don't ask Andrea out three times because she's going to say no. But probably, I reckon the main one is be careful who you trust, especially those who work in TV. So I think if I hadn't been so naive, then things might have been slightly different from that perspective.
Great advice.
And we always get some really interesting answers here, so please don't disappoint us. What are you reading or listening to at the moment? Apart from your own book, is there anything you'd recommend for our listeners?
There's nothing worse than please don't disappoint before you answer a question.
That's, no pressure.
No, that's like, well, yeah, I expect this to be funny. Yes, apart from my own book, or might as well say, I've actually written three books, just thought I'd throw it in there. Apart from the Identity Theft book, I've written a romantic comedy, which Ricky Gervais said is funny from beginning to end. Thank you very much. And I've written a book about how to write a sitcom. So I've done those as well. So obviously I'm reading each of those in turn. But to be truthful, at the moment, this is going to sound ridiculous. At the moment, I'm reading graphic novels because I'm a big comic book fan. So if you're expecting me to say some brilliant author, they are brilliant authors, but probably not the type that the majority we're reading. I suffer from insomnia really badly, and I find that reading comic books before I go to bed really helps me to sleep. So that's what I'm reading at the moment.
And looking more towards the future as well, maybe this time next year, what would be your prediction for how ID theft may evolve over the next 12 months? And are you hopeful that much will change?
Well, I'm hoping things will change, absolutely. I'm also hoping that, you know, my going around and speaking to companies and speaking to conferences will make people more aware of how serious the crime can be. Both from the, you know, from the point of view of the victim, and also for companies and authorities to know seriously what damage it can do. So I am hoping that that's going to help. Also, I've just started doing little online video things. I haven't put them up yet, but I want to do those. They're only going to be like short 5-minute bits, but they will, in theory, be funny and informative little videos. And I will be touching on things like phishing and vishing and things of that ilk, just to warn people in a funny way how seriously identity theft can affect their lives.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea kind of for the future. I might have to see if I can spot those and send them over to people like my family to make sure that they're kind of aware of these type of topics as well.
Yep.
But thank you so much, Bennett, for joining us today. It really has been fascinating talking to you. And as I say, you know, I found your book incredibly funny, but also at the same time, slightly scary maybe to think, oh, you know, what could be going on that I'm not even aware of? And I'm sure a lot of our listeners may also be thinking the same. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And we hope you enjoyed yourself as well.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. It's been a lot of fun.
And finally, just a last question. Where can our listeners, and me in particular, I mean, that's very high praise from Ricky Gervais, learn more about what we've discussed today? Where can they order your book and some of your other books?
Most things are available through my website, bennettaron.com, and the books are on Amazon. They're on Kindle. I think that's probably the main way of getting hold of stuff, I think.
That's great. Thank you so much, Bennett. And also thank you so much to all of our listeners today for joining us on this week's Fishy Business. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. If you have enjoyed the podcast for today, please do leave us a review on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you're hearing this. And feel free to follow us on our Twitter page @Mimecast if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today. Thanks, everyone. Until next time.